Hello, welcome to a podcast for charities from Farrow & Co. On the podcast today, I'm Lizzie Jones. I'm a partner in the charity team, and with me is Julian Smith, who is also a partner in the charity team at Farrow's. The topic that we're going to discuss today is the recent judgment of the Supreme Court in the Children's Investment Fund Foundation case, and some of the practical implications for charitable companies to think about. Julian, might you say a little bit about why SIF is such an important case for charities?
Well, partly I'd say it's an important case because the Supreme Court thinks it is. Lady Arden said very clearly in her judgment, or at least in her presentation of her judgment in her video summary, said it is an important case, and she's absolutely right. She's right for three reasons, I think. The first is because the case addresses and in part resolves one of the great unanswered questions of charity law, which is whether the members of a guarantee company, a charitable guarantee company, owe duties to their charity, and if so, what sort of duties? It's important because, secondly, it has some immediate implications for the governance of any charitable guarantee company, past, present, or future. And last but not least, I think it has wider implications for how the law might treat the actions of the legal members of any charity. And of course, it's a Supreme Court decision. So charity law doesn't get Supreme Court decisions very often. So it's authoritative, as well as being useful in all those spheres. I think it might be helpful to our listeners, Lizzie, if I maybe just say something about what a charitable guarantee company is before we get into the judgment itself. So a charitable guarantee company, it's a company, it's a Companies Act company, and it's a form of company that has really two tiers of governance. It has its directors who run the company, the charity, from day to day, and it has members who are a different tier in the charity company and have a slightly different role. Now, the court judgment actually estimated that there are about 33,000 registered charities that are guarantee companies. They tend to be the larger ones because they bring with them the benefit of limited liability. They have this two-tier governance structure, and they're like a share company, but they have no share capital. So the members have no financial interest, but all they do is they guarantee to make a nominal contribution on the insolvent dissolution of the company. The directors, the board of directors, they're the charity trustees. So as I said, they run it day to day. And the members are like shareholders. They're there to hold the directors to account and to make some big picture decisions, such as changing the charity's constitution. But often, not always, the directors and members can be the same people. So that's what a guarantee company is, a charitable guarantee company. Lizzie, why don't you describe for everyone the factual background and the judgments of the lower courts?
Sure. It will not surprise anybody to hear that this was a case where the parties involved had very, very deep pockets to take it all the way from the High Court to the Court of Appeal to the Supreme Court. Sad background to the case was the divorce of Sir Chris Hon and Jamie Cooper, who together back in 2002 founded the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, which for a period of time received a proportion of the proceeds of the hedge fund, the Children's Investment Fund. By the time of their divorce, it was one of the country's largest charities with assets over $4 billion and income of around $250 million. So this is a very, very large charity, and it made very, very significant grants beyond the UK. Julian's just described the structure of charitable companies and how they work with that member tier and the director tier. So at that member level with SIF, there were three members, who have rights akin to a shareholder in a commercial context. And those members were Sir Chris, Jamie Cooper, and a friend of theirs, Dr. Letta Mackey. And they had that level of member control. There was a separate board of trustees, of eight trustees at that other tier. Now, one of the areas for Sir Chris and Jamie Cooper to agree on during their divorce was how the work of SIF could be not divided between them, but how the philanthropic activity of them both would continue, despite the fact they no longer wish to do that within the same charity. The solution that was agreed to by all the trustees was that both of them would make a very generous contribution of $40 million to a new charity that would be run by Miss Cooper and called Big Win Philanthropy. And SIF would make a grant of $360 million to that charity. The trustees unanimously agreed that this was a good solution, and it brought this whole period to an end and allowed everybody to go off and do fantastic philanthropic work. The issue was that the trustees wanted the commission's blessing, and the commission said, "We think you should go to a court on this, get the court's blessing." And so the matter went before the High Court, and the Chancellor of the High Court ruled first that members of SIF owed it a fiduciary duty. Interestingly, he also alighted upon an issue that nobody had really paid much attention to, that the grant to the new charity was a payment to Ms. Cooper for loss of office, and therefore caught by a technical section of the Companies Act that said those payments must be approved by the members of the charity. And the High Court then approved the grant and directed Dr. Letta Mackey, as the member who was able to participate in that vote, to vote in favour of the resolution that was required under company law, thereby bringing the matter to a close. That decision was appealed to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal agreed with the High Court. Members of SIF, at this stage, that it was limited to in its application to the circumstances of the case, and it ruled that members of SIF owed it fiduciary duties. But the Court of Appeal found that the court had no authority to tell Dr. Letta Mackey he had to vote in favour of the grant. And that led to the Supreme Court appeal. I think before thinking about what the Supreme Court had to say on this case and on the appeal that was brought to it, it's worth just reflecting briefly what the High Court and then the Court of Appeal had to say around the fiduciary duties owed by the members of the charitable company as distinct from those duties that we all know are owed by charity trustees. Now, the Chancellor identified in his judgment a dearth of authority, and he says it is, there is no clear authority on the duties the members of charitable companies owe and what jurisdiction the court can exercise over them. But then interestingly, he goes on to say that it would be contrary to the whole regime established by the Charities Act 2011 if a member of a company such as SIF could vote in his own interests or in a manner detrimental to the charitable objects of the company. So, I mean, I think what brought him there was that while there may have been a lack of clear authority, it didn't come as a particular surprise to many charity lawyers that this was the court's finding, given it had been the view expressed in Charity Commission guidance quite some time before this case. The Court of Appeal then agreed with the Chancellor about the fact that members of SIF owed fiduciary duties. And part of their finding was that members don't sit outside of the company and are separate to it, but are as part of that administration of the charity. The purpose of their powers is about fulfilling the purposes of the charity, and therefore, those are powers to which duties attach because of the purpose for which they are serving as members. That brings us on to thinking about what the Supreme Court said on this case, what they had to say. The appeal was brought on to consider three issues. The first of which was the members of charitable companies are fiduciaries. The second of which was the ability of the court to direct Dr. Lettermäki to vote in a particular way. And the final issue was whether the fact that company law said that the member of the company had the right to say yes or no to whether this grant was made, was able to be taken away by and a direction given by the court in place of the member. Julian, might you walk us through what Lady Arden had to say on the question of members of charitable companies as fiduciaries?
Will do. She had quite a lot to say. And actually, I think we should be grateful to the Supreme Court and Lady Arden for the length at which she addressed this issue, because as we've already talked about, it's been something that's been a bit of a mystery to charity lawyers for a while. And her judgment goes a long way to clearing up the fundamentals of the issue. It was a rich and a nuanced judgment, and it will certainly bear rereading, and I'm sure that it will generate much learned debate in years to come. First and foremost, she decided that members of a charitable company are fiduciaries. In that sense, no great surprise. She pointed to Charity Commission guidance that had made this observation a number of years ago. But this obviously was the first time that there was clear and authoritative judicial justification for that statement. Now, she referred with approval to a judgment in a Bristol and West case, which states as follows, I think quite clearly, what the nature of that duty is. So what she quoted was this: a fiduciary is someone who has undertaken to act for or on behalf of another in a particular matter in circumstances which give rise to a relationship of trust and confidence. The distinguishing obligation of a fiduciary is the obligation of loyalty. The principal is entitled to the single-minded loyalty of his fiduciary. This core liability, she said, has several facets. Fiduciary must act in good faith, must not make a profit out of his trust, must not place him in a position where his duty and his interest may conflict. He may not act for his own benefit or the benefit of a third person without the informed consent of his principal. So there we are. Members are fiduciaries. That, in broad terms, are the nature of the duties of a fiduciary. Now, what she went on to say is that this duty is owed to the furtherance of the objects of the charity as opposed to the corporate entity. So a charity has charitable purposes. It is in the duty is owed to furthering those purposes. Now, she also said it's a subjective duty. So, in other words, it's for the member to reach a conclusion as a matter of good faith, what is appropriate, provided he doesn't do so improperly or unreasonably. If he does that, the court won't intervene or hold him liable, even if, in fact, it turns out he got something wrong in fact. So, fundamentally, subjectively, to act in good faith. Now, what she then went on to say is that this duty isn't exactly the same as the blanket duty owed by members of a charity incorporated organisation, although how different it is in practice, I think, will be a matter for some debate in the future. He said that the principle was universal. So in particular, the size of a charity's membership isn't a deciding factor in determining whether or not the duty applies to a member. It applies to all members in some shape or form. However, and this is, I think, the most important part of her finding, she said that the nature and extent of the duty has to be determined within the particular context of each individual charity. So context matters. And she also alluded to some principles that would then influence how this fiduciary duty would be shaped. So the same principle doesn't necessarily apply to all people with a lesser role in the governance of a charity. So we can say clearly that members of fiduciaries, that's not necessarily the case for everyone with a role in the governance of a charity. She also observed that a person with more than one relationship with a charity doesn't necessarily have the same duty applying in relation to each of those relationships. So if you're a member and you say have a contract with the charity, that doesn't necessarily mean you're a fiduciary in relation to the contractual relationship. And she also observed that the same level of duty doesn't necessarily apply to all powers the member might exercise, and should be suitable to the task. Now, she then went on to say that the context is primarily the articles of the charity. So you look at the constitution of the charity, and that's the really the mother source of trying to work out what the nature, the real nature of that fiduciary duty is. And particularly, she acknowledged that the articles of a charity might modify or qualify the duties of a fiduciary, as long as it doesn't impact on the irreducible core of fiduciary duty, which she described as exercising powers honestly and in good faith for the benefit of the charity. So, and is often the case in practice, the articles, for example, might allow a member to benefit to a limited extent from the charity, and for any conflict of interest arising in their participation in the charity's governance to be managed. She also said that context is also derived from the statutory regime within which the company operates. So, for example, the ability of members necessarily to obtain information about the charity doesn't stop them being fiduciaries. It just means that they're a certain type of fiduciary that has to act without necessarily all of the relevant information being available to them. And last, I suppose, but perhaps quite importantly, she also observed that the normal remedies for breach of fiduciary duty are in play. So with a duty tends to come a liability, and she acknowledged, although she didn't expand upon it, that that was the case here. So, headline, members are fiduciaries, but actually it's really hard to generalize over the nature of those duties. So, Lizzie, turning to the other aspects of the judgment, the justices were divided in their reasoning as to why Dr. Letter Markey cast his vote and whether he should on the direction of the court or not. So where did they get to on those points and why?
Thanks, Julian. I haven't got too much to say about this. And it was clearly an issue that I think the fact that the judgments were split on the answer to this question showed the slight difficulty that the justices themselves found in answering this question. I mean, the leading judgment on it, given by Lord Briggs, says, well, in this case, in these circumstances, what the trustees of SIF had done was surrendered their discretion to the court to decide what was in SIF's best interests, whether it was in SIF's best interests to make the grant. And you know, what the judgment said was that in this case, where surrender had been made to the court, the trustees had voluntarily handed over that decision as to what was in SIF's best interest in the court. And in the High Court, the Chancellor had ruled that in his view, and while it was a difficult decision, the court considered that actually it was in SIF's interest to make the grant for a variety of reasons, not least that it would unlock this additional gift by Jamie Cooper and Sir Chris Hone, to Big Win Philanthropy, so more money would be available for charity, and it would obviously resolve this long-running issue in the administration of SIF. And given that, you know, was the decision of the Chancellor, and that decision was not challenged, was not challenged by any of the parties, the result of that was that there's a slightly circular argument that in that case where the court has made that decision, if a member was then to vote against the grant, in a way that would then disrupt the finding of the court that it was in CIF's interests, then that would be a breach of duty. And that ruling, despite the fact that in this case there was no breach of duty, nobody knew, and Dr. Lettermaki had said he didn't, you know, he didn't at any point make his voting intentions known as to whether he would approve the grant. But the court said, notwithstanding that, because it would be a breach of duty for him not to vote in favour, the court is entitled to direct him as member to exercise his vote that's required under section 217 in favour of the grant. Does that bring us on to practical implications, Julian?
I think it does. So we've covered the technical points. Let's talk about what it really means in practice. Lizzie, what did you pick out of it?
I think I'm going to be reading the judgment for years to come and still thinking about it. I think there's an awful lot in there that goes beyond fiduciary duties. You know, there are long sections of the judgment that talk about the court supervision over charities, and so it's well worth a read if you've got a few hours to spare. But while it has obvious relevance to charitable companies, there are certain types of charities that I think it could have quite profound impacts on, including corporate foundations, where the sole member is the business. You know, it is very easy to see that where there are tensions between the business and the foundation of which the business is sole member, that the fact of those fiduciary duties could create difficulties. I think the second type of charity where this judgment might have quite significant implications for it is where you've got charities that are in and that have corporate relationships with each other, where you have a charity or a group of charities that is the sole member or a member alongside other charities of another charitable structure. And I think there are obvious difficulties there because you obviously have the board of the parent charity that has duties to it, but also in exercising any member powers over the subsidiary charity has those duties that must come first and foremost when those member powers are being exercised. And the third type, and I'm sure this isn't a definitive list, I'm sure there are others that could be added to it, is philanthropic foundations, where membership control vests, as with CIF, with a small number of individuals that have a personal connection to each other. And philanthropists might be looking at the structures they're using and the forms of the way in which they have certain controls or powers in relation to the charities that they fund, you know, how robust they still feel those structures are.
That's interesting. So clearly some issues around the way charity groups are put together and a way around the way individual charities are put together and whether or not the constituent elements now need to adjust their expectations about what they can or can't do. Lizzie, one thing I was pondering was where this judgment takes us in relation to some other elements that I think of necessity, the judgment didn't necessarily touch upon, but I think lawyers reading it will be immediately thinking about the implications. One of them that struck me were the boundaries of the judgment. So obviously this is a decision about guarantee companies, but it makes some very general and pertinent points about the natures of the duties of members in relation to charities at large, which I can see being quite easily applied by us lawyers to other forms of membership charity, maybe to CIOs as well. Lady Arden specifically said that the statutory CIO members are not necessarily exclusive, but also other forms of not-for-profit companies, so community interest companies, which themselves aren't charities, where they do have a purpose and where there is an asset lock. think the boundaries of the judgment are quite interesting. Second area that interested me was about the liabilities of members. So, as I said earlier, duties and liabilities tend to go together. And you have a breach of duty, let's say the members don't behave as the law expects them to behave, the law expects there to be some consequence. Now, sometimes fiduciaries can limit those liabilities. Sometimes the constitution of the charity will limit those liabilities for them. But fundamentally, I think it might come as a surprise to some members of charities that actually in operating as members, they might have some, not only some responsibility, but also potentially some liability for the decisions that they take. The other area I thought was interesting was in the other roles of governance within a charity, because Lady Arden did say quite clearly, well, you can't necessarily assume that just because members are fiduciaries, so is everybody with a role in the operation of a charity. Now, it was a very broad statement. I don't think she was necessarily aiming at any particular other form of role within the governance of charity, but it did leave a question hanging. So people have powers of appointment within a charity, people have a power of veto, sort of elements of powers that sit around the edge that have been given to third parties, possibly for perfectly legitimate reasons, say in a protected role or otherwise. You know, we now have to stand back slightly and ask ourselves the question, well, are they fiduciaries? Are those duties they exercise similar to those of trustees, similar to members, or again, something quite different? Now, I think all of these questions at one level might all sound a bit academic, as most members of charitable companies probably act in a way that they consider to be in the best interest of the purposes of the charity in any event. And I think it's fair to say that members don't regularly make momentous decisions on behalf of their charity. I do think we have to hope that Charity Commission guidance is going to be produced, at least if nothing else, to probably stem the stream of inquiries that the Charity Commission might have to face if they don't produce that guidance. But having said that, we shouldn't rush to any immediate conclusions, I think there is plenty to be thinking about at a rather more practical level. Lizzie, do you want to say something about some of those more sort of immediate considerations for charities?
Sure, Julian. I mean, we haven't got time to really delve into the full range of the implications. But I think some areas that we're thinking about, you know, do we need to do something now? What's the right approach? Even if we haven't got all the answers now, what should charitable companies be doing? I mean, I think there is scope for thinking now. Firstly, is what is the nature of these responsibilities that members hold, particularly where members are being asked to make big decisions and there are decisions on the horizon. I mean, is it fair for trustees not to tell members something about the fact that they do owe these fiduciary duties? And therefore, should a charity be thinking about what guidance it needs to offer members? Does it need to offer them, you know, training might be taking it too far, but at least to tell them the approach that they are expected to take in taking that decision and in thinking about the interests of the charity in a sensitive way that doesn't suggest to members that previously they haven't been doing exactly this. I think that, you know, so there is a sort of education point, you know, what do we need to tell members and can we help them through some, you know, difficult challenges where they are uncertain as to how they should exercise their duties as members properly. I think the second issue, which is, you know, often a difficult issue for charities, but we're now expanding it from it being an issue for trustees to it being an issue for trustees and members of charitable companies, is thinking about sort of procedural issues in the context of general meetings and AGMs, and specifically how members should be dealing with any conflicts of interest they have when they're asked to exercise any their decision-making powers as members. For example, do they need to be declaring conflicts at the outset? Who do they tell about that? Do we, for that charities, want to start thinking about, registering interests of members? I suspect the answer to that is no, but that is obviously what happens for trustees at the moment.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it, Lizzie? I mean, I can see some interesting general meetings coming up where the chair tries to assert some authority over whether a conflict has arisen or not. One specific that came up in the judgment is perhaps also worth mentioning, which is where members are voting in their own election as trustee or director. I think Lady Arden said quite clearly that she thought that in the normal course that would not be appropriate. Not many elections, or the expectations of who might vote in those elections, now needs to be modified.
I mean, Lady Arden was also, in thinking about what the nature of these duties were, she was quite clear that they were duties that had to be interpreted in the context of the Articles of Association, of company law and charity law, and expressed the view that the nature of those duties could be shaped by the articles, and that obviously raises the question whether a company's articles are fit for purpose when it comes to members, or whether there are any revisions that it might be sensible or appropriate to make in light of the judgment.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have a sort of latent concern that those members who are addressed with this issue go looking to the articles for comfort, and of course they won't really find it at the moment, because up until this point in time when articles were written, this was an issue that people had in mind when they were writing the rules that members were expected to follow. So might well find, I think, a lot of charities looking at their constitutions now and thinking, is this really fit for purpose, or do we really need to at least start adding in some more explicit guidance to members about how appropriate it is to do this or not do that? One of the specifics that also in me was whether or not there will become an appetite in the articles of charitable companies to begin to insert some form of limitation of liability for members when it comes to their fiduciary duty. Because it's not uncommon for a provision of that kind to appear in the trust deeds of charitable trusts. So maybe this is something that charitable companies will start putting into their constitutions as well. I also did slightly mischievously wonder what the indemnity insurance industry would make out of all of this, but that's another story for another day.
Absolutely. There might also be some consideration of the nature of any third-party rights in the articles and whether those are fiduciary rights or not, given the comments in the judgments that in some circumstances it may be the case that, for example, veto rights over particular decisions may not be fiduciary in nature, and therefore those rights may arguably give the individuals holding those rights greater scope to take a decision they want to take, free of the concern as to the interests of the charity. But I think that point is not uncontroversial, because, I mean, previously we have seen those powers and third-party powers as fiduciary in nature, and also we had previously interpreted them as also needing to be exercised in the interests of the charity. And so I think there might be a little bit more thinking to do before anybody does anything dramatic on that front.
I can certainly see the Commission rushing in with some guidance on that point.
Sort of limiting the scope of what that might mean, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think the final implication is obviously the court had quite a lot to say as to its ability and powers to supervise charities. And whilst there are few charities out there with the resources that SIF had to bring a legal case of this kind, one must wonder whether intractable issues may trouble the courts more frequently as a result of this judgment, whereby the court has been quite firm in noting its ability to intervene in the running of a charity, to an extent, I should say. Julian, have you got anything else that you want to add?
Only to say that I think we'll be having discussions like this for weeks, months, if not years to come in many different forums. It is one of those judgments that is going to take time bed in and for the legal community to digest. But I do think it is a landmark judgment, and it'll be really interesting to see how opinion forms around it and gets translated into practice.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think all that is left to say is thank you very much for making it to the end of the podcast. We hope you found it interesting. And if you do have any feedback, please do feel free to drop me or Julian a line. Thank you.
Thank you.